Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we'll hear from a purveyor of AI slop about the content he puts into the world and the future of the technology, and what to do about the number of Arizona high school students who are chronically absent. But first, Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum celebrated the one-year anniversary of her inauguration on October 1st, and it has been an eventful 12 months. With me to talk about Sheinbaum's first year in office is KJZZ's Nina Kravinsky from our MOCO Bureau. Nina, good morning.
Good morning.
So I think we probably have to start with Sheinbaum's relationship with the U.S. and specifically President Trump, who was, of course, inaugurated in January. What is the view from Mexico about how she has navigated her relationship with President Trump?
Yeah, so, you know, I think people in Mexico largely agree that Sheinbaum has had this really difficult task. I would say almost since her inauguration a year ago, certainly since Trump took office, you know, she needs to walk this tightrope between standing up for Mexico's sovereignty on security issues, but also making sure the U.S. and Trump sees the Mexican government as a partner and not the enemy on those issues. You know, Sheinbaum's government has handed over some really high-profile prisoners associated with organized crime to the U.S., and it's been highlighting busts of drugs and weapons within its own borders. But at the same time, she's repeated over and over again that she won't stand for unilateral military action or intervention from the U.S. in Mexico. And of course, all of this is happening within the context of tariffs, right?
Yeah.
Mexico's been able to avoid the worst of Trump's tariff threats. But, you know, many people would say in large part because of Sheinbaum's ability to negotiate successfully with him. Before Trump was even inaugurated, he was saying he was going to put a sweeping tariff on all goods from Mexico and Canada if they don't help him meet goals on immigration and drug trafficking. And while there are new tariffs on Mexico, on cars and goods not covered by the trade agreement between these three countries, many of the things that people are buying, let's say at the grocery store in the U.S. from Mexico, avocados, cucumbers, peppers, those things remain tariff-free, which a lot of people would say is really good news for Mexico's economy and for consumers in the U.S.
Yeah. Does it seem as though President Sheinbaum's strategy for working with the U.S. and this administration has been steady over the last, you know, 9-10 months or so? Or does it seem like maybe it's evolved over time?
Yeah, I think it's felt pretty steady. I mean, you know, really early in her administration, she would repeat this line about having a cabeza fría, a cool head, a cold head, you know, sort of say, you know, her strategy has been dealing with things that the Trump administration does rather than necessarily the things that the Trump administration says it's going to do. So she hasn't reacted too quickly or too, you know, too aggressively necessarily to things that the Trump administration says it's going to do, and especially in the realm of tariffs and also in the realm of security, and instead sort of likes to negotiate and deal with these things as they come on.
So speaking of the economy, it seems like one of the other big issues that President Sheinbaum has had to deal with, in addition to tariffs from the U.S., is Mexico's relationship, especially economically, with China. How has she tried to handle and maybe in some ways massage that relationship?
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, Mexico's under pressure from the U.S. to reduce its trade relationship with China. Mexico's planning to put a hefty tariff, for example, on all cars coming from China, along with other tariffs on imports from the country. And at the same time, Sheinbaum's also seeking to boost domestic production on all sorts of things in Mexico as part of her Plan Mexico. You know, those are products as diverse as beans and rice to semiconductors to electric cars. You know, Sheinbaum would say that boosting domestic production really helps Mexico in a lot of ways. An analyst would say that one big one is to help show the U.S. that Mexico is committed to buying less from China.
Well, so how is that going? Because, you know, lots of countries, including this one, say they want to produce more of their own goods. Easier said than done. So how is it going in Mexico?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of initiatives that she started sort of, talking about boosting these sectors. But I would say in the day-to-day, you can still see Chinese products, all over Mexico. And Mexico's still very reliant on trade from the US as well. One thing that I've observed here in Hermosillo, Mark, is that, one of the places that you really see lots of influence from China is on the roads. We had our car in the shop for a big part of the summer, and so we were pretty reliant on Uber at that time. And so many of the Uber drivers who would come pick us up are coming to pick us up in electric vehicles from China, these BYD electric cars from China. There's tons of them on the roads here, but soon those cars will have a tariff, that they'll be more expensive to buy here in Mexico. And so that could really change, and these other tariffs could change how consumers sort of shop here in Mexico.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So, Nina, let me ask you lastly, sort of looking ahead a little bit, talking about trade and the relationship between Mexico and the U.S., looks like there's going to be maybe some negotiations on revisions to the USMCA, which is, again, sort of NAFTA 2.0. What are we looking for in that area?
Yeah, I mean, I guess in a way, these possible renegotiations really cast a shadow over all of this. Trump has said he wants to go back to the negotiating table for this trade agreement. He doesn't have to, but he said he wants to over the summer when it's up for a review period. The Trump administration could use that as another leverage moment with the U.S. and Canada to try to achieve goals on security and that kind of thing, drug busts and the cartels. Mexico and Sheinbaum are, of course, very aware of that and the possibility that more tariffs could be coming from the Trump administration. So, what I would say is these delicate negotiations between these two administrations really are continuing.
Yeah, sure sounds like it. All right. That is KJZZ's Nina Kravinsky reporting from our Hermosillo Bureau. Nina, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
The new Sora app from OpenAI, released last week, sits at the top of Apple's App Store rankings. Sora lets users quickly generate AI videos in pretty much any style, meaning our social media feeds could soon feature a lot more realistic-looking and yet not real videos. The genre has been dubbed AI slop, but despite the name, the videos can generate millions of views and money for some of the people posting them. One of those people is a Valley resident named Eric. He asked us not to use his last name for safety reasons. Eric is the person behind Infinite Unreality and posts AI-generated videos on several platforms. He came by the studio recently to talk about this, and we started our conversation by talking about what he thinks of the phrase that's used to describe what he does, AI slop.
AI slop, man. I mean, it's definitely a negative term. It sounds negative, but at the same time, I think it's valid. I mean, it's just at the rate that you can pump out AI content, it has to be slop compared to what people are actually making out there with their hands. So, I don't take it too critically because I don't really have a ton of, I'm not spending hours and hours every day on this stuff. So I don't really have that much of an opinion on it. But yeah, I mean, I think it's just one of those terms that people use and it's kind of just become a popular term.
But it doesn't bother you, it doesn't sound
no,
like.
No, it doesn't bother me at all.
What appeals to you about doing this?
Well, I don't know if you know about why I started doing it. Just to get views. That was really it.
It was really about attention.
It was really about attention. I had a YouTube channel when I was younger, and I've always kind of wanted to keep doing that. I mean, almost anybody, if you send them a bunch of likes and follows to their account, they're going to go, wow, this is amazing, right? I mean, there's a feeling, there's a dopamine rush that you get from that. And that's kind of what I was always craving. But at the same time, I didn't want to put a ton of work into it. And so I just figured, what is the easiest way for me to get followers with the minimal or the least amount of effort as possible?
Is there a goal, though, to do something with those followers? Or is it just about accumulating views, accumulating likes and clicks?
I mean, ultimately, I saw it as a possibility to make some money off of it. But as it's come along and I've gotten followers and stuff, I kind of realized that monetizing the actual videos themselves is not really possible. But then again, it is a very unique niche. There's a lot of companies that are looking to use generative AI for marketing and whatnot. So there's a lot of value just when it comes to consultations and commission work even. So that's kind of where all the money comes in. Long-term goal, I don't really know. I don't have any plans to expand it necessarily. I thought maybe it could be some sort of AI video production company, but who knows? Things are changing so quickly. In my personal opinion, I don't think it's going to exist in a year from now. Or,
really?
Or my channel. I think it's going to, at least if it exists, it's going to be something completely different.
How come?
It's going so fast. Things are changing. There's not going to be anything unique about it here soon enough. So
because everybody's going to be able to do it.
Everybody's going to be able to do it.
How do you try to figure out what kinds of videos you're going to make?
So I don't come up with any of the ideas. Not
you
a
just type
one.
It into like ChatGPT?
Yeah. So when I started, obviously I was taking other videos that I saw that were doing really well. And I said, let me try to replicate those. Just get the style down more than anything. And then over time, it just kind of started to understand what I was looking for. And then I started feeding it the data of my recent videos and what videos did well. And it just kind of adapted towards shock value and bizarre stuff and just trying to get as many views as possible. So all I do is I open my chat that I have and I say more, and it just gives me more prompts and we just go from there.
So like, what is your role in putting them together? Because it sounds like the AI is coming up with the ideas. The AI is obviously generating the images. Are you just posting them? Is that basically the extent of what you're doing?
It's pretty much like that for the most part. I mean, there's different steps along the way, and obviously AI is doing those steps fully, but I kind of have to bring it from step one to step two.
Are you concerned about people watching your videos and thinking that they're real in any way?
No, that's what I want.
You want them to think they're real?
That's what I want. That's what draws engagement. I mean, I think a lot of them are very bizarre to the point, and even so unrealistic to where there's no way it could possibly be real. But just the fact that it's shot in a realistic style and it's that handheld camera kind of feel, I just kind of knew that people would think it's real. And as long as I get them for the first 2-3 seconds of that just drives the engagement up. And that's the whole point, is just keeping people on the video as long as possible.
Are you not concerned about people thinking that something that is AI generated is real?
Not necessarily, unless it actually can harm people, I guess. Unless there's something of real substantial value to that mindset, I don't think I'm really... I mean, maybe I'm traumatizing people in a sense. Maybe they go, oh my God, that's real. And it's not actually real. And they never get that answer. And maybe they're forever scarred because the baby had, you know, 4 heads or whatever. I don't know. I mean, that's definitely a possibility. But for the most part, I'm not trying to trick people. I'm not I label all my videos AI. You know, I abide by the rules as much as possible with that. It's just a matter of are people, and I think a lot of people just don't really pay attention to social media as much.
So one of the videos that you've created that seems to have been pretty popular is there's a woman at a gate at an airport with a kangaroo holding a boarding pass. And the woman and the gate agent are speaking in, I don't know if it's a foreign language or a made-up AI language, but it looks like the woman is trying to get the kangaroo on the plane because it's holding a boarding pass. And it strikes me, like listening to you talk, that if people think that's real, they might think, what kind of madness is this, somebody trying to get a kangaroo on an airplane, and also who would get them a boarding pass? But also, like, it's not totally outside the realm of possibility that somebody would try to do something like that, right?
Mm-hmm. I think that's the reason why the video did so well, is because it was one of those videos that looked really realistic, but it also wasn't unbelievable by any means. It wasn't too far-fetched. I mean, I think a lot of people just thought it was a skit. And so the reason why it blew up was because, you know, they saw it. They're like, oh, this is a cute little skit. Let's move along. And then somebody posts, oh, did you know the kangaroo video was AI? Then everybody freaks out. 500 yeah. million views in 24 hours.
Wow. So, yeah. Is that your highest viewed
Not personally, video? But that was one of those videos where it got stolen by almost every single account, reposted. You know, I think I have 20 million on my account, but I counted every single other one. It was about 500 million, 24
wow.
hours. So
wow.
Yeah.
So what does that do for the other videos that you make? Like, that seems like a really high bar to try to clear in the future.
I mean, I have 30, 40 videos that have done better than that.
Really?
On my channel.
Wow.
Yeah. When it comes to like a global reach, that's definitely done the most. And I don't know if it'll ever kind of reach that again, just because that video really kind of made people realize that AI videos can look realistic. And I don't think there's that kind of shock factor anymore.
That is Eric. We're only identifying by his first name. He posts AI-generated videos under the name Infinite Unreality. More of our conversation in just a moment. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, one doctor's long, strange trip through the world of public health. We'll hear from a former Arizona State Health Director about his new memoir. But first, let's return to my conversation with Valley resident Eric, who's the person behind the AI-generated video site Infinite Unreality. We're only identifying him by his first name. He mentioned that monetizing these kinds of videos, often referred to as AI slop, can be tricky. And I asked if he makes money off the videos he posts.
Not from the videos themselves. On YouTube, I could do it. But YouTube, I don't get any views for whatever reason. I've had people steal my videos and post them on YouTube and get millions of views. For some reason, I can't get it. So all the money just comes from commission work and, you know, consultations and stuff like that.
And have you gotten gigs from other people who have seen the AI videos you're doing and liked them and said, please come do that for us?
Yeah. Yeah. I've gotten many, many, many companies. More so just from a consultation standpoint, just kind of them coming to me and saying, is this possible to do with AI? Because I think they're just, everybody's trying to utilize it as much as possible, because it can, I can create a video for $400 that, you know, would cost these production companies tens of thousands of dollars to hire actors and do all that stuff. So,
and presumably it doesn't take you all that long to do this, right?
It takes me, well, if you're talking about the videos on my channel, it takes me 2 seconds. If you're talking about those things, I mean, 10 minutes. My AI knows the videos that I want. Most people want videos that I make or videos similar to that. So I tell my AI, here's these people who are reaching out for this reason. I feed it all the information. It comes up with everything for me, even on the commissions and all that stuff. So,
has your AI ever generated anything that you, for whatever reason, didn't want to post? Like you didn't think appropriate or you weren't comfortable with it?
Plenty of times, yeah. It happens all the time. For the most part, it knows. It knows the rules. It knows kind of what Instagram allows and what it doesn't. I'm also on TikTok. You know, I'm on every platform. But yeah. They all kind of allow the same stuff.
So right? You have to make sure that it's not violating the rules of the platform you're on.
But it's difficult because there's a lot of things that my videos portray that if it was a real video would not be allowed. But because it's not a real video and it's technically art, I don't know if they know how to even moderate it. You know, it's happened so fast and so quick. I mean, I don't know.
What do you think the future of AI looks like?
I think it's going to be good early, and then it's going to be bad.
Is now the early time, you think?
No, I think now is early.
Okay.
I think within 10 years from now, 2035, our lives are going to be completely different.
How so?
I have a theory that in 10 years from now, we're not going to have to work. I think there's going to have to be some sort of universal basic income. And, you know, even with that, I don't know how people are going to be satisfied with life. I don't know.
Because AI will be doing everything.
Because AI will be doing everything. And even though we're going to be able to live and eat and you know, not have to work, what else are we going to be doing with our time? We're not going to be using social media, because social media is going to disappear, because there's so much AI-generated videos that nobody wanted to be on the platforms anymore. You're going to go on Netflix and it's going to say, hey, what kind of movie you want to watch today? And it's going to give you 10 different versions of whatever you want to watch, and you just watch whatever, and maybe you own that movie and you can share it to your friends, but there's going to be just so much media. It's insane.
It's so interesting because the future you're describing strikes me as at the same time utopian and dystopian, like all in one.
Yeah. It's tough to really know how it's going to be. because I could speak about this all day, but there's a few different outcomes. None of them are good. None of them are good.
Do you think that you're contributing to that, though?
I guess to a small scale. I mean, I think that's probably the reason why I get a lot of death threats all the time is just the fact that I'm utilizing it. But then again, everybody else in this world is going to have to use AI or else they're going to fall behind. You gotta look at it in the perspective that everything is going to be easier with AI. And I don't think I'm a bad actor. I could easily be a bad actor if I wanted to be. I'm one of probably the 10 biggest AI creators, video creators in the U.S. I could make any sort of propaganda video that I want and trick millions. That's not my intent. That's not my goal. But I just think people need to be aware that these things are possible, whether it's videos, audio, you know, emails, whatever it is. Just you have to be aware of what's possible in this day and age.
Well, this is what I think scares the bejeepers out of a lot of people is that you can make these videos and you can make them look really realistic and you can have whoever you want saying whatever you want them to be saying. And for at least some number of people, they're not going to know the difference. They're not going to know if you have person X saying this or politician Y or athlete or musician saying something that they didn't actually say. So like, is there a way to reassure people? Is there a way to convince them that you're not going to go rogue and start making propaganda videos that are intended to mislead people?
I mean, I can say that I'm not going to do it. I don't think me as a person really means anything. I don't think there's anything special about me. I'm not a genius. I just decided to jump on it at the right time. And, I mean, that's obviously a big factor in doing anything. It's just doing. Anybody could do it. It's just if they, you know, care enough to look into it.
But presumably not everybody has the mentality that you have. They don't have the morals or the ethics that you have. And they are willing to. I mean, we've seen it, right? We've seen people having famous, you know, videos of famous people where they are words coming out of their mouth that they never actually said.
Yeah. No, I see it all the time. And a lot of it's, you know, for the most part, it's comedic purposes. You know, it's them saying something completely outrageous that it would never be believable. Of course, there's always going to be people believing everything. Just that's the way it is. But yeah, I mean, I think what we really got to hope for is that AI is good at detecting AI and we can utilize that AI to recognize all these things and hopefully keep our platform safe. But it's things are going to change and they might change for the good short term, but long term, who knows?
Buckle up.
Yeah.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Eric, thank you so much for coming in. Thanks for the conversation.
Thank you so much.
Lookout, if you haven't heard of it, is a nonprofit independent news outlet that covers the LGBTQ plus community in Phoenix. And recently, their editor-in-chief and founder, Joseph Darius Jafari, sent out a note to readers addressing their use of a particular word in their coverage, queer. It's been used as a slur in the past, but today it's become something of an umbrella term. Another example, they use the acronym I just used, LGBTQ+. They don't say LGBT or the longer version adopted by some in the community, 2SLGBTQIA. Why not? And how does the current political discourse over free speech play into it? My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with Jafari more about it.
If you think about who our readership is and who the queer community is, right? It is a community that adopts language pretty freely. You know, they are early adopters of culture and language, and they are, you know, have a large number of people who are part of activist communities who adopt different language than what maybe you and I typically like use in our news reporting. And so it's important that, you know, as we're reporting to that audience, but also to a wider audience, because we do a lot of republishing, that we're using language that everybody understands. Yeah. But the second reason why we did it is because one of my reporters kind of came to me and they said, listen, I'm not sure how I feel about certain words that we use. And part of being a transparent and community news organization is making sure that we listen to our reporters as well, because they're on the front lines and they're talking to people. That made us go, okay, so let's take a step back, because if, you know, our reporters are feeling uncomfortable, we don't want that. We want to make sure that they go into the field and are using the language that the people that they're talking to are using.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the examples of that, right? Like, you use the term LGBTQ plus, and there are other forms of that. The New York Times will just say LGBTQ. AP Stylebook says LGBTQ, but without periods, right? This has been an evolving kind of label for the quote-unquote queer community, and queer is another term I'm sure you've debated. How did you land on LGBTQ plus?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to kind of go into the history of that. You know, first it was GLB for the longest time. And then during the AIDS crisis, when we recognized the lesbian community really stepped up for the gay men, the history goes that then it turned to LGB as like as a manner of, you know, respect. And then, of course, you know, trans people became part of the community because they were so tantamount to the importance of the Stonewall movement. And then, of course, to the gay rights movement generally. So then it became LGBT. And, you know, now we've kind of like expanded and grown it. You know, queer is now a word that has become so commonplace, and it's become this ultimate umbrella of the culture and the people who are within the community. But there's also two-spirit. There's intersex. There's asexual. And so one of the things that we have to do as news people, our job is just plainly to make the news clear.
Yeah.
At Lookout, we are not advocacy news. We're not activist news. We really kind of make a stand with our community being like, we are not any one thing. We are just news. We are as if the AP took queer news seriously. And so we will not use, you know, 2SLGBTQIA is a mouthful, right?
Yes.
But on top of it, it's something that only specific people really use in specific spaces. Mm-hmm. LGBTQIA, not a lot of people use it. And at the end of the day, when we're writing stories, we have to wonder, because we do republishing, how much do we have to explain to a general audience what the IA means? How much do you have to explain what the 2S mean? And so we kind of settled on LGBTQ plus is pretty encompassing. People understand what we're talking about. That's kind of the point of the plus.
Yeah.
But again, this is why we did a check-in. Is this not complete enough? Is this something that people are not using generally?
So you're kind of getting at this idea that you're covering a community that is often on the forefront of change, but you're not doing that as journalists covering it. You want to be responsive to it, though.
Yes, 100%. I think this is the problem that we kind of come across when we talk about news generally. And I know I'm going to probably make some enemies within probably the younger generation of news people here. But at the same time, news is not supposed to be the movement maker. We are supposed to be following the movements. There's, of course, space for movement journalism, but that's not what we are. We have to make sure that we're using the language that everybody can understand. We're not documenting just a movement. We're documenting a people that is pretty wide encompassing, that isn't monolithic by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. Let me ask you about the kind of broader political moment we're finding ourselves in right now as you're debating the use of these terms and trying to be kind of neutral about it, right? Clear about it. The political divide is clear right now, even in the language that we use, right? Like if somebody says transgender ideology, you kind of know what they mean or where they're coming from, right? And the same can be true for things on the left. If somebody uses that full term, the 2S included, all that kind of stuff. As journalists, though, as you're saying, like, we're not supposed to take sides. Do you feel that tension in this debate for yourself today?
100%. I mean, listen, I say we're not activists and we're not advocates because we aren't. Like, to me, that is a level of journalism where we won't cross a line in opposition to our community. But we will, if our community does something bad, we will be the first to cover it, right? However, you know, we absolutely come to the news with a perspective. We come to the news with the perspective of, I am a gay man in Arizona that shouldn't really have to debate about my right to exist, right? Mm-hmm. And so we kind of cover it from that perspective. We will never claim to be an objective news source. And any news outlet that claims to try to strive for objectivity, I will argue, is fooling themselves. However, one of the things that I often think about is how for a long time, just within queer spaces, right, that people have been afraid to talk about queer people in ways that they understand because they're afraid of saying something wrong. And we have had to deal with the fact that when people who are part of this community have policed what people can say or what they should say, you've now had an opportunity for conservatives and very far right people to use that as a weapon to get people to essentially be against the community, make them seem as an enemy and make them seem as they are the police. When at the end of the day, we're all just trying to understand what we're saying to each other.
That's so interesting, because what you're getting at here is a really big piece of the political debate in the country right now, right? Where we have seen so much criticism from the right that the left had gone too far in policing the words people use and policing language and how people talk about themselves even. And they've called that an infringement on free speech. But now we're seeing kind of a big backlash to that and lots of questions from the left about the same thing. What do you make of that as a journalist who covers the queer community?
My main thought on it is what we're witnessing right now is whiplash politics. One side of the aisle or one group of people, they just really doubled down on their language as like, this is how we speak. And for a while, there was no opportunity to question it. Mm-hmm. And not that everything needed to be questioned, but there needed to be a moment of getting people to understand what the language was. Arguably, the language that queer people are using is not wrong. Using non-binary pronouns is not wrong. It's not grammatically incorrect, but maybe there needed to be a moment to just get people to understand rather than like bludge them over the head with it. That's kind of our opportunity as a queer newsroom right now, is that we are trying to write the news in a way that everybody, no matter what side of the aisle you're on, you can understand what we're saying. We're not using, for example, you know, there's a story that we did where a trans woman said, like, I'm not a trans woman, I'm a woman with trans experience. And I said, I don't really think an audience outside of the queer community will understand what the hell that means. At the end of the day, I have to write, and we have to write for an audience in Arizona that may not be fully understanding of what exactly the experiences of these people are. But we need them to get them to get to a point of understanding. That is the goal. And so that's kind of how I've approached it, is that, you know, I'm not trying to advocate that queer people went too far or anything like that. But I definitely think that now is it's an important time to absolutely get people to get into that understanding phase of this is why the language is being used in the way it is. Yeah. And there's a reason for it.
That's really interesting. Thank you so much for that take and that explanation. That is Joseph Darius Jafari, the founder and editor-in-chief of Lookout, joining us. Joseph, thanks as always. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. More than 30% of Arizona high school students were chronically absent during the 2023-24 school year. That means they missed at least a tenth of the school year. That percentage is lower than it was a couple of years ago, but still higher than pre-pandemic levels. The findings from Helios Education Foundation also find discrepancies between which students are missing school and which aren't. Schools in lower income areas, for example, have more students than are chronically absent. English language learner students, Native American students, Black and Hispanic students also have higher rates of chronic absenteeism. Paul Perrault is Senior Vice President of Community Impact and Learning at Helios Education Foundation. He joins me to talk more about this. And Paul, let's start with what stands out to you about the report.
What really stands out is that, you know, you start looking at high school students from grade 9 to 12, and that they're missing more school than any group of students along the continuum. We really saw that around 21, 22, that the percentage of students that were chronically absent, meaning missing 18 or more days of school in high school in Arizona, was about 42%. That was up from 24% before the pandemic. And the last year that the data was brought out released in 23-24, it's down to 34%. You know, still basically one in every three students is missing more than 18 days of school in Arizona high school. And that's just really challenging as we think about them being ready for workforce, them being ready for college, having opportunities after high school. Those are the big things that stand out to us.
Do we have a sense of why they're missing so much school?
You know, we continue to work with schools and districts and other partners to think about, you know, the reasons why. And what we've learned along the way is there's a number of reasons. Number one, we saw that people got used to, and students as well, got used to not being in school during the pandemic. And we saw chronic absence rates really kind of start spiking at that time and after. And they've stayed high. And so kids got used to being able to go to school when they wanted to and not having to be there all the time. We're running into more and more kind of transportation issues. And I think you'll see, we can see stories all the time about different districts in Arizona, for example, canceling bus service. So transportation issues. How do you get your students to school? Mental health is still a big issue after the pandemic as well. And so, if kids don't want to go to school or if there's other issues that they're having mental health issues, you start adding all those factors up, the mental health, the transportation. And lastly, some students we learned really have to help support their family, whether they're watching younger siblings, working themselves to help support the family. Those are a number of reasons that kids are just not in school all the time, especially in high school.
Is it safe to say that some of those factors might be easier for schools and districts to address than others?
Definitely. I mean, when you start thinking about issues like, transportation or getting kids just used to being back in the school, there are definitely interventions and support practices to get students back to school on those areas, to make them understand that school is the most important place for them to be during the day. There are other issues, like I mentioned, the mental health. Sometimes that does take more outside supports. And that's why we really stress that chronic absenteeism is not just a school issue. It's a community issue. And how do we make sure that we're supporting our students, supporting our families? If they need Dexter daycare support, if they need mental health support, if they need transportation support. So definitely there are some issues that the schools can work on a little bit easier. And then there's definitely issues that they're going to have to work out and reach with the community.
It seems as though there's pretty broad agreement that chronic absenteeism is a problem that needs to be addressed in Arizona. I wonder, from your perspective, is there agreement on solutions? Is there agreement on what to actually do to try to bring the number of kids who are chronically absent down?
There definitely is agreement in certain areas, and I'll talk about a couple of the areas that Helios has worked with partners around the community. Number one is just being more using data to drive your discussions and your decisions. So, we've partnered with United Way Valley of the Sun to really help understand and help train teachers and school districts to use data to understand who's missing school, help identify interventions that will support them. We've partnered with Read On Arizona, and they've really done a great job of identifying interventions and supports that schools can put in place and really make that a kind of a community kind of decision. We've talked to other groups that, and we looked at research about what's working. And what we really see that's working and that people can agree upon is that those kind of incentives to bring students back into school that are not punitive. So how do you have the family support, the community support, talking to students, having those relationships? Those are what the research really show are improving chronic absenteeism rates, and that's where we have agreement around how we can support those students.
One of the other ideas that has been brought up is essentially keeping kids back, holding students back if they miss too much school. I'm wondering if you think that would be an effective strategy.
Well, the strategy when you start being punitive really kind of misses the idea of root causes. And we talked a little bit earlier about mental health, transportation. Punitive nature isn't always going to get to those root causes, and we want to solve the root cause. So we really want to focus on those strategies that we can actually get to the root cause, solve them, like transportation, mental health, daycare. That way, we're going to see students get back to school.
Do you think that it is realistic to think that the numbers will get back to pre-pandemic levels?
We think it can be realistic. We've seen some really positive outcomes with some of our partner schools and districts who have put in intervention supports, really made chronic absenteeism a focus. And so we have no doubt that with the work and with it being a community effort, that we can see an increase in or a reduction in the chronic absenteeism and an increase in students actually graduating, having the ability to go to college ready for the workforce.
Well, and it also seems as though some of the solutions that you've talked about are easier to do in a timely manner. Like when you talk about trying to figure out transportation, I'm not saying it's an easy thing to solve, but like there are options out there to get students to school that you can do fairly quickly. When you talk about, sort of changing the culture and reminding students that being at school is the most important place, and it's not great just to sit at home in your pajamas or just say, I don't feel like going today. I'm going to skip today. That seems like maybe a harder thing, a longer term kind of proposition to pull off.
Definitely, Mark. And that's why our recommendations really start with some of those focused ones early high school intervention. So how do we implement freshman year support, such as mentoring and personalized attendance monitoring, to prevent early disengagement, making sure that we integrate attendance data, you know, using that attendance data with interventions to really target and support students. Having that culture that you just talked about is so important. So, you know, moving away from compliance to celebrating strong attendance, those are ways that we can do things quickly and easily that you're going to see some positive impacts really quickly.
Do you find that the factors and the issues that you need to address in high school are the same as the issues that, you know, students in elementary school or middle school are dealing with? Or is this a whole different situation for high school?
It's a different, very different situation. And as a father of a high school student right now, too, you know, I see some of those issues where it can be easy for your student to think that they, you know, I don't need to go to school. I can catch up online. High school students, you know, typically have different teachers, you know, and so even tracking attendance gets more difficult in high school as students have different teachers. They go from one class to another. Sometimes students come in late. Sometimes they leave early. And, you know, as students are older, they're more mobile. You know, I can leave school. I might be driving at the time I'm 16. And so the issues that are in high school, you know, they're going to get much more pronounced because those students are going to have an opportunity to decide if they want to go to school more often than not.
All right. That is Paul Perrault, Senior Vice President of Community Impact and Learning with Helios Education Foundation. Paul, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mark. Have a great day.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Anyone who grew up here in the Valley in the 1990s might recall a memorable anti-smoking tagline designed to gross you out. Tobacco, the tumor-causing, teeth-staining, smelly, puking habit. The line was part of a campaign by Arizona's health director at the time, Dr. Jack Dillenburg. By the time he got the call from then-Governor Fife Symington to run the health department, Dillenburg already had a fascinating life full of plot twists, from his work with a group of California yogis to his time providing free dental care while living in a straw hut in Jamaica. Dillenburg published a memoir earlier this year called You Don't Know Jack, and he spoke with my co-host Sam Dingman about what he calls his long, strange trip through the world of public health. They began with Dillenburg's childhood in Queens, New York, where he joined a local Boy Scout troop.
And so I joined the troop, and next thing you know, they made me senior patrol leader,
yeah,
representing all these very affluent folks. And I was the only one that wasn't, but it worked out real good. And, you know, I'm a half-breed Jew. It was a Jewish troop that I didn't join.
Right,
and that's
right.
That was one of the things that made it really interesting.
Well, so let me ask you about this. Let me ask you about this, yeah, because this is a very interesting part of your story, I think, that sure, if I'm not mistaken, your father was Jewish, your mom,
yes,
was Protestant.
That's correct.
And at the time, if I'm not mistaken, your brother was having a little bit more trouble with authority, shall we say?
Yes, 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 he was. You know, he was a different guy. He and my dad didn't get along, and I think, and he was 8 years older than, 7, 8 years older than me.
Yeah.
He did a lot of dope. He sold pot, uh-huh, and he didn't get along with my dad. My dad did stamps and opera. That was his thing. He didn't have okay, a baseball glove. We didn't have a catch. Uh-huh. It wasn't your typical Queens, New York family.
Uh-huh.
And I had to find my own way out in many regards.
Yeah. Well, eventually you end up at Tulane University.
Yes.
And you're a New York kid.
Yep.
And
yep,
now you're in the Deep South in the 1960s, yep, and you start to really see segregation for the first time.
Yes, yes.
And that has quite an effect on you, right?
It does. It does. It really hurt me to see how Black people were being treated. And I had a 1910 Chevrolet, and we were driving to a civil rights event, mm-hmm, and we stopped in Southern Alabama for breakfast with the guys in the car. And all of a sudden, this guy walked over to our table and looked at me. He had his suspenders, a heavy, big belly,
yeah,
and he looked at me. And I stood up. I said, yes, can I help you? He said, what are you doing here? He said, well, I'm here for this. He said, you are. Well, I think you better get out of town before I really hurt you. And he hit me. He hit me in the stomach,
God,
real hard. And I fell over, uh-huh, back in my seat. So we didn't finish our trip. We went back and realized that America is in a difficult stage right then.
This is a really interesting pivot point in my mind in your story,
yeah,
is that,
yeah,
you know, you really come face to face with a lot of the hypocrisies in exactly. American culture.
Yes.
And one of the reasons that you went to dental school was to make it less likely that you were going to have to go fight in Vietnam because you had a very high draft number.
Seven.
Yeah, that's pretty high.
I said, I do not want to go to Vietnam.
Of course. Yeah. So, but interestingly to me, after you study dentistry at NYU, you do end up enlisting in the Navy.
In the Navy.
So and tell me about that transition.
Absolutely. Great question. And you know, I was the class president, and being the class president
at NYU,
in the dental school, they picked one of five people to go into the military, and they said they'd like me to join that. Would I be interested? I said, yes, would I get to pick where I get stationed? That was my key, Sam. You know, I didn't want to go to – so I wound up – they let me pick one of three sites in California.
Yeah.
Well, there's a part before you complete your naval service that I'm also very interested in, which is, as I understand it, at some point you get exposed to the writings of Richard Alpert, who later changed his name to Ram Dass.
Yes.
And got very interested in his philosophies and yoga in particular.
Yes.
And you end up going to work with a guy named Swami Satchidananda.
Satchidananda up in Northern California.
Yeah.
Swamiji.
Well, appealed to you about that? What was interesting to you?
Well, it was just that it was dealing with people and dealing with their core values and their basic beliefs. And realize that we can make a difference in the world.
Yeah.
And I think that was something that struck me right to my heart.
Sure. Well, so one other part of your journey that I'd love to ask you about that happens shortly after this time is I know you dealt with some real personal tragedies. Your girlfriend was killed in a car crash. And in your period of grief after that, some friends recommend you take a trip to Jamaica.
Yes.
And you go to Jamaica and you arrive in Negril, Jamaica, and you're out to dinner the first night you're there.
Yeah.
And as I understand it, you end up having an encounter that night that completely alters the course of your life.
Yeah, no, meeting Bob Marley. And I got to meet him and become his dentist. So I was Bob Marley's dentist in Jamaica. It was amazing. I lived in that little house you see on the cover of the book.
Yeah.
And I built it out of leaves and things, and it's right on the sand. And I didn't take any money from people.
Right.
I got paid by the Jamaican government.
Yeah, tell people, I mean, you weren't just doing this, you know, ad hoc. You were working for the Jamaican Health Ministry.
Jamaican Ministry, and they loved me. They wanted me to speak to them because they saw that I was a bright guy. And then, you know, I get the call to go back to the States. They come to Harvard. Harvard.
Well, so what was it? What was it about what you were doing in Jamaica that Harvard called you about? What were they interested in?
They loved that here I was, this guy just teaching kids how to take care of people's teeth and just being down to earth, because there were so many people out there that couldn't afford dental care and couldn't have access.
Right. And that's a lesson you learned in Jamaica?
That's correct. Uh-huh. And then coming out to Arizona, that was another thing that just surprised the hell out of me.
Well, so let's talk about that. Yeah. This is where that fateful phone call from Governor Symington comes into play, right?
Comes in.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so, I never met the man.
Uh-huh.
And I got a call. I said, He says, this Jack? I said, yeah, you're the dental director. Is that right? Uh-huh. And from Harvard? I said, yes. Would you please come to my office and see me? So I said, yes. I went over to his office, went up there, said, Jack, you don't know me, but everybody thinks you're great. I'd like you to be director of the state dental health department. It was amazing. And he gave me I had 5,000 employees, and I brought all this stuff to the health department that wasn't there before, and taking care of people, taking care of poor people and things.
Well, so as the director of the Arizona Health Department, you, among other things, come up with these very memorable anti-tobacco ad campaigns. You came up with
tobacco,
the slogan,
tumor-causing, teeth-staining, smelly, puking habit.
Yes, exactly.
Correct.
And there's,
that's the one.
What do you think was effective about that slogan?
I think that it came out of nowhere and just got people thinking reality. They didn't realize that tobacco was so bad for them.
Yeah, there's something so blunt about that slogan.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you as a last question, Doctor.
Sure.
There's this recurring theme in your story of people just kind of say, like, you know, I think I want that guy to be in charge. What do you think it is about you?
I think they appreciate my honesty. Mm-hmm. They appreciate my commitment to help everyone. I'm not trying to just help rich people. I look out there now, and you got people, all they want to do is help the wealthy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And help white people or whatever might be a priority. And I want to make sure that America can be the great country that it was and will be again.
Well, the book is You Don't Know Jack, My Long Strange Trip Through the World of Public Health. And I've been speaking with the subject of that book, Dr. Jack Dillenburg. Dr. Dillenburg, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you so much. I so appreciate you taking the time and doing this. And please know, Sam, that if ever I can help with anything, the price is right.
Okay.
All right.
And that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.